You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
At the beginning of The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide to Capitalism and Socialism with a Key to the Scriptures, a father gathers his three adult children to have them vote on whether he should commit suicide. The play goes on to address issues like prostitution, radical politics, commitment, family dynamics, among other things. And joining me now are playwright Tony Kushner and Linda Emond, who plays one of the children. The play is being produced at the Public Theater in partnership with the Signature Theater Company through June 12th. And it is my pleasure to welcome both of them back to our show. Hello.
Hi.
Tony, what was the inspiration for this play? Was there a particular event that sparked it?
I think it's partly turning 50, which I did 3 years ago, and dealing with people of the generation ahead of me, my parents' generation, moving into old age and dealing with old age issues. I think that that was a deep underlying cause of the play. Probably most specifically, the two things that affected the shape and the substance of the play are I've been for the last several years editing Arthur Miller's plays for Library of America. And so I spent a lot of time with Miller's work.
The family drama aspect.
The family drama.
Even though they seem to be family dramas and they're often about other things, but in the end it comes down to the family dynamics of those plays.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that sort of post-war family drama model for me, and I think for a number of people in my generation of playwriting, has become of a kind of a new interest. Also, I was starting to work on the play right around the time of the Writers Guild strike, and I think even more significantly, the local one, Stagehands strike. And
so you're thinking about unions.
I think a lot about
unions
and their role in society and the way that conversations about the Stagehands strike, especially among people who I would have assumed would be pro-union, were sort of shockingly anti-union and Reaganite, and that made me realize the degree to which some of the fundamental assumptions that brought about the birth of trade unionism and a worker's right to organize had sort of been undermined by the last 40 years of conservative thinking.
And here we have that debate going on right now.
Yeah.
As a result of what's happening in Wisconsin, Ohio, and elsewhere. You seem to have a certain prescience. Angels in America, Caroline, or Change explored the possibility of having a black president before most Americans had heard of Barack Obama. Homebody Kabul, that was first produced a few months after September 11th. And now you've written a play that discusses the achievements and history of organized labor at a time when we're seeing labor unions struggle and under attack.
Well, and unions, of course, have been struggling and under attack both culturally and legislatively and judicially for quite a while. So I don't know about prescience, but I mean it feels like I don't think it's surprising that at this moment of immense transition in American society, one of the fundamental questions, I think, in modern civilization, which is the relationship of people to their employment and the relationship of people to the wealth they help create and the relationship that society has to wealth. I mean, these are sort of fundamental issues. And I think what we're seeing in Wisconsin and in the Midwest, you know, and all over, I mean, teachers' unions, I mean, in Cuomo's, you know,
right here in New
budget
York.
In New York, I think we're seeing.
And Michael Bloomberg now.
I mean, yes.
And with his idea of seniority.
Right.
Well, names seem to be very important here. And Linda, your character's nickname is Empty. Mm-hmm. But you're not empty in any way.
Not in the least, no.
The other kids are Pill and V.
Mm-hmm.
Not their real names either. What did you make of being called Empty?
Intriguing from the beginning, most of all, because, of course, I knew that Tony Kushner would never write a character that was anywhere near empty.
Well, it's her initials, but it's spelled E-M-P-T-Y.
It is. It's spelled empty, but it stands for Maria Teresa, M-T. No, I found that really compelling, that there was probably something that Tony was either consciously or unconsciously addressing there that had to do with a kind of Was it a vacuum he was after, or a kind of a vortex, or just simply the opposite of empty or something? It's just always been intriguing.
You're looking at me like I'm going to give you an answer. I don't know.
I'm assuming the names have significance, especially the name of the father, Gus Marcantonio.
Well, Marcantonio, of course, has immense significance. It's Gus is a fictional cousin of the very real Vito Marcantonio, who was a six-term congressman, radical congressman from East Harlem, part of New York City and America's left history that's been, to some degree, forgotten. But Vito Marcantonio was a really remarkable guy, and I felt a interesting example of Italian-American political radicalism, which is something that I'm intrigued by and I think is maybe a little underexplored.
Marcantonio wasn't a communist, but the communists all
He wasn't a member
him.
Of the Communist Party. He was essential, for all intents and purposes, so closely aligned. He was the candidate of the American Labor Party.
And Gus Hall, no?
No, I wasn't thinking of Gus Hall. It sort of struck me a little bit later that was unfortunate. Augusto just was a name. When you're making up these people in the first place, I spend a lot of time trying to figure out their names, and I tried a lot of different Italian-American names, and I liked the name Gus. I've realized since that, of course, it has a certain and Gus Hall is mentioned in the play because this character, Gus, is a member of the Communist Party. The thing that I didn't mention in terms of, like, things that catalyzed the writing of the play is that I wanted very much to write at first for two specific people, two actors that I'd worked with, Stephen Spinella, who I wrote the part of Prior Walter in Angels for, and who I've known, I think, probably as long as I've known anyone, and worked with, since I was at the very beginning of my career. And then Linda, Linda and I worked together with great joy on the hour-long monologue that starts Homebody Cobble. And I decided I wanted to make them brother and sister. And one day in the shower, it occurred to me that their names would be Pill and Empty. And I have various theories now, but I don't actually know. I just thought, oh, that's great. I'm going to do that. So,
well, most of the cast have been in previous Krishna plays, haven't they?
Well, Christopher and I have known each other as playwrights for a really long time, and he is my agent's brother. And Joyce Kate, who I've been with since 1984. K. Todd Freeman was in Angels in America. I'm going to get in trouble if I try to make a list right now. Yeah. Who else am I forgetting? Most of the others are new to me. I mean, Michael Esper, the wonderful actor, was in the Guthrie production. Mm-hmm. Danielle Skrestad is new to me. Stephen Pasquale and I have known each other, but he's playing the third sibling, and he's fantastic. But I'd never worked with Stephen before, so.
Well, Linda, what kind of relationship does your character Empty have with her father, Gus, who's played by Michael Christopher? Played, by the way, we must say, as a force of nature by Michael Christopher.
Yeah. I think that's huge. Plus, we're so in the middle of it still and developing all that. But he's the most potent force in her life and has been since she was a child, and is both the reason why she's clearly absolutely the reason why she's chosen to do what she has in her life. And also some of those reasons, though, come from the need to create a distance also from what her father is.
But she's a labor lawyer. But
she's a labor lawyer now.
She's not a communist as her father.
No, not at all. Not at all. No. And I think for her, on a just very simple level, her love for her father is intense and really beyond all other things. And so his suggestion that he wants to end that life is devastating to imagine. And that is a huge amount of what I spend my time doing in the play, is trying to save his life.
Everybody tries to convince him not to kill himself.
Mm-hmm. Not everyone. Not everyone necessarily in the play.
Well, there's some people who move back and forth, but mm-hmm. Here's this man who dominates the lives of all the people around him. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to imagine, I guess, even if everybody's rebelling against him, life without him.
Absolutely, yeah. But the some of the beauty, I think, of the play is that it is not at all a simple case of everyone is trying to save their father's life. That's not what happens in this play. That's not quite as simple as that at all.
Well, nothing is simple in this play. You've made it even more complicated than you've done in the past. It's almost as though you're trying to break all the rules of theater and create a new kind of verisimilitude. The set looks like a real house, which we've seen in the past. But everybody talks over everybody at different times. Is that something that you wrote into it? Did you write everybody speaking simultaneously?
Well, you know, I mean, this thing that happened in the English language theater in the mid '80s, when Carol Churchill, the very great British dramatist, first started actually scoring into her plays, overlapping, and I think of it in our little world of playwriting as being something similar to Marlowe inventing the sonnet form. I mean, after this idea comes into the world, everybody, it's irresistible. It's like everybody wishes they had thought of it, but Carol thought of it first. And in plays like Top Girl and Fenn, I mean, she does it to really magnificent effect. I remember Jonathan Miller's production of Long Day's Journey Into Night, where he decided to sort of Carol Churchillize it, and everybody was talking on top of everybody else, which I think is maybe wasn't, you know, such a good idea. But with this play, I mean, I lived for 13 years in Carroll Gardens and in an Italian-American neighborhood, and I would hear family arguments through the walls. And, you know, there was a certain kind of liberated rage that was fascinating to me, coming from a sort of more southern, buttoned-down Jewish family. And I began to play with overlapping, and then I began to really sort of have more and more fun with it. And we got to the point, it was a sort of a discovery at the Guthrie, which is where the play first appeared 2 years ago, of having 11 people on stage for a very long time all talking at once, where it's actually not possible to hear everything that's being said. And the audience then has to sort of decide who they're going to listen to and who they're going to follow. And
although you do get a sense of what all those conversations are, and we've all been in rooms where people have paired off and are having separate conversations, some of them getting rather heated. What about for the actors, Linda? Some of those must have been very difficult to stage.
They are, although, you know, what was great is doing it here in New York after having done it in Minneapolis, having the new people come into it and start to try to do it. And there's a resistance immediately, because the feeling at first is, I can't possibly speak and listen at the same time, because Tony's written it in such a way that there are times when you are head-to-head having a supposed conversation with someone, but you're both talking at the same time. So that seems impossible to do. Likewise, then, at the same time, you'll end up having two other conversations, or someone else says something to you and you have to. But we would just say to them, which proved to be true, have patience, and you will see pretty quickly that you can actually talk and listen at the exact same time, and in fact hear what two or even three different people are saying at once.
And we've all had that experience as well, where we're engaged in a conversation and something that the person is saying behind us sounds a lot more interesting than the conversation we're having. But I would assume also Michael Grieve, who's worked with you in the past, played a major role.
Michael directed the revival of Angels. It's a signature right now. And we've worked together in 1990 at the Public when he directed my first play, A Bright Room Called Day.
So he had to work out all of
those. Yeah, because I will
dynamics.
Say that something that Tony hasn't done, I've never asked you this, Tony, I don't know if you plan on doing it, but I've done Carol Churchill where it's scored, and she actually shows you
in
the script.
Where to come in.
She has a symbol that she shows, a slash, and that shows you where you come in. Tony hasn't done that. And so although it's clear that he knows the way he's laid it in, how it doesn't, sometimes it just sort of naturally works. Michael Grieve deserves a lot of credit for having really helped score those, that he has come to have an understanding of what should come in where, and, oh, you need to come in three words sooner, and you need to come in. And so some of that isn't. Do you plan to put that in?
No, I don't, actually. I like the fact that it's I mean, first of all, with 11 people going on, I don't even know.
Yeah.
I mean, they'd have to have not just one slash mark, but like, you know, stars and diamond shapes. I mean, I like that a director would have to organize each time. One thing that we had to really struggle with the cast, and it's a lesson that we learned at the Guthrie, is that actors are naturally sort of considerate for the most part of one another on stage. And so if somebody's having a conversation that feels to the people having it that it's happening at the same time as another conversation that's sort of more important to the storyline. There's a sort of a natural impulse to get softer. But the only way that this thing works is if everybody's at the same level so that the audience can actually say, I'd like to listen to what they're saying, and then tune their ears in and hear. It all fails if you tune your ears in and you can't hear. And the audience has this kind of interesting reaction. There's a kind of a panic at first that they're missing stuff. And then they start to realize that we're not going to let them miss things that they need to hear. Mm-hmm. It gets very quiet at times, and then it gets crazy again. And then they sort of begin to go along with it, and it just gets nuttier and nuttier. And
I think it's great. From audience to audience, it's different. At the beginning, it's different because Tony challenges the audience in different ways at different times through the play. So sometimes he makes it much more accessible, and they can enjoy it and have fun. And then sometimes I think in a very useful way, they get frustrated. And that's okay. You know, they get frustrated. And then there are times when then they surrender to it. And it's interesting.
And you say fun because there are a lot of very funny lines in this play as well, despite all of the serious issues that are addressed. I'm talking with Linda Eamon, who is one of the stars of Tony Kushner's play, The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide to Capitalism and Socialism with a Key to the Scriptures, which is a co-production of the Signature Theater Company and the Public Theater. It's at the Public through June 12th. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Linda Eamon, who is one of the stars of Tony Kushner's new play. Tony Kushner is also here. The play is The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide to Capitalism and Socialism with a Key to the Scriptures, now at the Public Theater. And let's talk about that title for just a moment. You couldn't do it in most theaters because it wouldn't fit on the marquee.
Well,
doesn't have a marquee.
It probably doesn't have a marquee. That's a good – and we sort of call it IHO for short, like an iPhone, because that is a thing in the play. It's, you know, it's based on Shaw. Paternal grandmother died, I went down to Louisiana to help my father pack up her library, and she was a good product of New York City public schools circa 1910, and she had a very sophisticated library with Shaw and Ibsen and Dickens, and I was helping him pack up her books, and I found this volume I'd never heard of by Bernard Shaw called The Intelligent Woman's Guide to Socialism and Capitalism. And I loved the title, and over the years it's changed, and I knew I wanted to make a play of it someday, and so here it is.
The play is set in June 2007. Why did you choose that specific moment? It was right before the housing market collapsed.
That's sort of the reason. And also,
had the collapse occurred when you started writing the play?
Yes, it had. I wanted to deal with a moment right before the market, when there's enough evidence that the market is about to tank, because that features in the play. And also before the 2008 election really became so much the central concern of the day that I would have to make that a part of the play, because I didn't really directly want to address that. It's mentioned. Linda's character, Empty, is looking forward to a time when the Democrats take over the White House and
assumes that things will be better.
Hopes. Mm-hmm. Yes, she does.
And she's right. They are better.
Yes, they are.
They're tough, but they're better. Mm-hmm.
That's a whole other show.
Yeah. Well, I think it's important that we take stock of the fact that things are better, because they're not going to get better unless we pay attention to the ways that they've changed since. Mm-hmm.
Well, Carroll Gardens has changed a lot over the course of the ownership of this house. The family got it in the early 20th century.
Yes.
Probably bought it for a song. And by the 2007 and so, it was worth many millions, as most of those houses are.
They're getting a very good price for it because of a circum. We won't tell what it is, but because that's a surprise in the play. But they're getting a bigger price than they should. But it's they're selling it for several million dollars.
And Gus, almost in this case, seems to be seduced by capitalism, at least by certain aspects of capitalism.
Well, at various points, Gus is a man of his world and of his time, and there are ways in which the play, addresses the fact that money as a sort of a symbolic language that supersedes, in a certain sense at this point, almost all other languages, is something that we all contend with. It's a language that we all speak. And as a man who loves his children and wants to leave them provided for after he does this terrible thing that he wants to do, he's very much aware of how much one needs money. And the contradiction is there. It's a family of originally anarcho-communists, but they become real Marxist-Leninists in the 30s. They got their hands on this house that they used to rent in, and they've always had this kind of secure financial base that they don't really acknowledge, but that's there.
And so Gus became a communist, but then the kids reflect the changes that have occurred since, and each one of them is a little further removed from their father's communist politics. The youngest son, V, played by Stephen Pasquale, is quite different in his relationship to his father and his relationship to politics than his siblings.
Yeah. I mean, we're Empty is a very much of the left, but a progressive Democrat, a Michael Harrington Democratic socialist in a way. Her brother, Pill, who's gay, is very interested in labor history and in the history of the labor affiliated left, but is someone without a who's much more a product of LGBT culture of the 70s and 80s
and screwing up his life like mad. Has nothing to do with politics.
Well, I think it has a lot to do with politics, but it's he's having his own. I mean, the family is both very functional and very dysfunctional at the same time.
Now, Lydia, you've been with this play for 2 years since its premiere. Has that allowed you to really figure out who Empty is?
I have the great benefit, and also it's been a problem, that I think Tony would fully admit that in Minneapolis, Empty hadn't been really fully created. And the benefit of that for me is that the difficulty of that was that, of course, it's not, it's a difficult thing to try to play something that really isn't completely right. But the benefit of it has been me having the great joy in having a collaboration with Tony, which I've enjoyed before, of trying to develop something. And I think she's taken the biggest journey from Minneapolis for sure. And seeing that has been exciting and complicated, but ultimately really great. So,
well, actors have often told me that it takes the run of a play for them to truly figure out the person they're playing.
Yeah, we had.
I always get the feeling that I should see the next to last performance.
Yeah. Yes, there's definitely some truth in that. I mean, right now, I know that you saw it, Leonard, over the weekend, but excuse me, it's changing still. We put in a bunch of new pages last night.
New pages,
Yeah. Oh yeah,
and a bunch more, some on the way.
Some on the way, one probably more a little bit significant change to come, and then some other smaller things. So it's still very much in transition. And yes, absolutely, you're right that for actors, it goes on till the very end. It's a constant process of discovery. It's like making a rug or something. I don't know, there are 1,000 different metaphors I can give, but weaving in that many more little threads into the tapestry of it is what we do.
Two of Gus's kids are gay, or one is gay and one is bisexual, but I guess choosing to be gay.
I think she's gay, but
they're grappling with making long-term relationships work and dealing with their own families as well. Obviously, that's something that you wanted to deal with. In a family drama.
Sure, when I wrote Angels in America, I was 30 years old, and so was Stephen Spinella. We're the same age. And so when he was in Angels, it was watching a man who, at this point, from the vantage of being 53, I can say, is am I 53 or 54? Oh, my God. I'm middle-aged. I can't remember. However old I am.
Michael Christopher's character is constantly suggesting that he has Alzheimer's, although he obviously doesn't. But I guess every time we have one of those memory lapses, especially when we forget our own age,
have a different relationship to older people. When you're the generation that is now in its the octogenarian generation, septuagenarian, octogenarian generation is now that's about to sort of, you know, that's all between you and the edge of the cliff is the only generation between you and the edge of the cliff. And as soon as those people have gone, along with the great cultural loss that that suggests. I mean, Gus is a member of a generation that lived through the Depression and World War II and a great deal of history, both left history and just world and American history. And I love those people and feel like I've learned so much from them. That's my father's generation. And when they're gone, you feel that an entire, you know, direct connection to a world is gone. And also then you're next. So you're watching an older person's memory lapses, but you're also aware that every time you can't remember a name, you're moving a step closer.
In the course of the play, we find out that Gus is working on his translation of one of Horace's epistles, and his translation is even included in the playbill. I don't know whose translation that actually
Mine.
Is. It is. Oh, well. Why is that important to Gus? As a way of well, first of all, he's a person who has actually chosen not to seek higher education. He's an autodidact. And he wants people to know just how smart he is. At the same time, he has perhaps he's smart enough to have pursued something more than he did.
Well, I mean, he's somebody who's made a conscious decision. It's sort of I'm not sure that you can call a member of Gus's world an autodidact because that it is technically true, but autodidacticism as a kind of an individualist, you know, I've trained myself. I think that Gus has also been intellectually trained by his culture. I mean, you know, if you read Das Kapital at, you know, 16 or 17 or 18, it's going to, you know.
Or if you go to Catholic school and study Latin.
Well, and there's also there's a whole generation of
Americans who studied Latin.
Yes, exactly.
My father.
My nieces who go to school in Vienna in Austria are learning Latin and Greek. You realize that it was part of somebody's education. He's been on a guaranteed income, won in a 1973 strike this entire time. And one of the ways that he's filled up his time is to learn Latin.
Well, Linda, so we have Horace's epistles. We have obscure points of Christian theology, labor politics, assisted suicide, real estate bubbles. But as I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of humor in the play. Have you been surprised by where the audience laughs?
Yes and no. I know from working on Tony's stuff before that he does a kind of wicked thing. If you're an actor in it, sometimes it's painful. Because you can be in a place of great difficulty and pain, and he purposefully will burst the bubble of that a little bit for reasons of the play and the dynamics of the play and everything else, which can be complicated to go through. But you still take great pleasure in the fact that the audience is enjoying it immensely. No, I don't think. Overall, though, I think that it's Tony can be very, very funny. There's no question. And so, I mean, that's a totally joyful thing to do on stage when you have the opportunity to open your mouth and say something and know that you're going to bring great enjoyment to people, period.
Although I also should point out that a woman behind me was sobbing loudly during the third act.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you have two plays in New York right now, the revival of Angels in America, and then this one, and a third one soon to open?
I'm the playwright this year at the Signature Theater, the playwright in residence or whatever it's called. And so the third play, the revival of my Corneille adaptation, which is in English called The Illusion, directed by Michael Mayer, with a fantastic cast, Lois Smith and David Margolis and Peter Bartlett and all sorts of other wonderful people. Henry Stram, I shouldn't go into names, but that will be opening sometime in, I think, early June. We go into rehearsal the day after Pesach is the only thing I know for sure. I have a Seder with 34 people coming, and then the next day I have to go into rehearsal.
Well, this play, which stars Linda Emond, who's been here, along with Michael Christopher, Stephen Spinella, Stephen Pasquale, Brenda Whale. Is it Whale?
Brenda Whale.
Who plays Gus's sister and gets a lot of the laughs.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
And a wonderful cast in all is unfortunately only running through June 12th because something else is coming in, or?
I think because one of the actors has a pilot. something else is coming in the public. I don't know.
For one thing, I think that's normal at a not-for-profit theater that you have a run that you establish, and that's where you sort of begin and plan. But yes, beyond that, I do think there are some conflicts, so. It's tough tickets right now, people. So right now it can be tough. Get out there. Pick up your phone.
The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide to Capitalism and Socialism with a Key to the Scriptures, now at the Public Theater in a co-production with Signature Theater Company, running through June 12th. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard. Great to see you again.